now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my guests are Jerry Marzynski. Jerry really needs no introduction. He's been with us a number of times before. In my view, the leading authority about the intrusive thoughts, the voices that people hear. People mistakenly diagnosed as schizophrenic when actually they are under a form of malign entity influence. Which accounts in part for the voices and other efforts at manipulating the behavior of the people thus affected. And we have a friend of Jerry's, Jenny. Jenny has had a career in this kind of field, and she sees things from both perspectives. You've already heard from Jerry in the past. We'll let Jenny introduce herself and tell you about how she got involved in this. Hello, Jenny, and welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hi, Jenny. Thanks. yeah, I've been practicing as a hypnopsychotherapist for just short on 20 years. And I'm in my 50s, but in my early 20s, I was diagnosed schizophrenic. And I experienced a lot of these kinds of psychic attacks, if you like, by these entities that I believe now are hanging on to us in large measure. And Jerry and I met a couple of years ago when you were doing the last rounds of interviews, Jerry, just before you wrote your book. And I was intrigued about the idea of the negative voices, these voices. And I think at the time I was still piecing together parts of my own history. So when I came across Jerry, it was another key in the lock, if you like. It was another part of explaining my own history, and something that, you know, has really broadly expanded my idea of what happened to me. Because you do honestly, and Jerry will explain this as we go through, that you do believe, obviously, that these voices or these entities aren't separate from you, they are you. And this is where the problem arises. So I hope that explains who I am.
Thank you, Jenny. And Jerry, yeah, why don't you lead off and kind of lay the groundwork and tell a bit about the findings that you've come up with, the correlations, and how you came to be associated with Jenny, and then we'll have just a general discussion about the findings and correlations you and Jenny have come up with.
Okay, very, very briefly, in the background, I've spent 7 years working at one of the biggest, or the biggest state hospital on the planet. There were like 10,000 patients there when I first got there. And the schizophrenics intrigued me. And I was finding a lot of conflicting evidence from what I'd been taught in graduate school. Here, psychiatry is saying these voices are hallucinations. But I started seeing patterns appear. One of the first was they were anti-religious. They didn't want the patient reading the Bible. They didn't want him going to church. They didn't want him talking, saying prayers. Why would a hallucination do that? So that was the first one that got me. And then from the psychiatric point of view, here they are dishing out these medications saying that schizophrenics had a chemical imbalance in their brain. I never saw ever them give any kind of test that measured any kind of imbalance of any kind. And later found out that they do not have one. There is no lab test. There is no EEG. There is no EKG. There is no test. Scientific test for schizophrenia. So these guys just pulled that out of thin air. And what they do is it's like pin the tail on the donkey. They have this formulary of any toxic, very toxic antipsychotic medications. And they just go, oh, well, we think this one will work. And they try it off with that. If that doesn't work, they do another. If that doesn't work, they do another. They do another. There's no science to it. And these antipsychotics are basically dangerous neuroleptics, they rot out the patient's peripheral nervous system. They shrink the brain. They cause untold damage with long-term use, resulting in something called the Thorazine shuffle, where the person can't even walk with a normal gait. And the state hospital was full of these people. Now they're all in state prisons. They closed down virtually all the state hospitals and they're just running the skeleton crews. But there was contradiction after contradiction after contradiction. And the evidence became more and more that these things are independent entities. And I denied that for years. I mean, even past the point where the evidence was real clear. I still didn't believe it for probably a decade until one day what I figured I'd do would be tell the patients I was working with that I was working with the criminally insane in the state prison at the time. So I figured I'd do the opposite, or ask the patient to do the opposite of what the voices were telling them to do. And that had a reaction. It was a negative reaction on the part of the voices. And if they persisted, the voices got angry and then started to weaken. So as people began to get better and better and the voices came less and less and were not as strong, one of the prisoners I was working with came to my office and it was one after another, different ones saying the voices are getting mad with you. They're really getting pissed at you. What are you talking about? You know, hallucination getting pissed with me. And they'd go, they're not hallucinations. And I didn't, you know, I was unsure. And then one after another, there were several that I was working with, all came independently saying the voices are really getting pissed with you. They're really getting angry at what you're doing. And then one day, one of them came to the office without a appointment and said, the voices want to talk to you. And that had never happened before. It was like, you know, I'd talk to the patient would tell me what the voices were saying, but not in this case. And I was kind of shocked. And I said, come in, well, tell me, what do the voices have to say? And these words came out of his mouth. You have no right to interfere with our way of life. And it was plural. And, well, you know, it was coming out of the patient's mouth. And the prisoner said, that wasn't me, that was them. You know, I didn't say that. That was them. And I was shocked. That's when I realized that these things were independent entities. They were not hallucinations. They were not some figment of the subconscious like I thought at first. I didn't stop working with that fella. And about 2 months later, he came into the office and I had read something in one of Miguel Ruiz's books stating that these things were energetic parasites. And I'd already seen that after the voices attacked, every single schizophrenic reported that their energy level had dropped to zero. And I thought that was due to the how scary these things were. You know. But then I had a situation where I was over the jail for the prison, and there was a florid psychotic locked in with a prisoner who had snitched off the gangsters. And the gangsters were trying to kill him. He was there for protective custody. He'd already been stabbed a couple of times in one attack. And I got a letter from that prisoner stating that his roommate or his cellmate was nuts and he needed help. At the same time, I got another call from the captain of that unit to come over and take a look at this guy who was psychotic. And I pulled them both up. And the first guy I talked to was the one the gangsters were after. They wanted him dead because he snitched off a drug deal. And it cost them not only all the drugs, but they broke up the gang and sent them to all prisons all over the state. So they were really after this guy. And they wanted him dead so bad that they were getting in trouble on purpose to get thrown over to the central detention unit so they could have a chance to kill him. And they would throw these notes under his door saying, you're dead, man. We're here. We're waiting for you. First chance I get, you're done. And then he's locked in with this florid psychotic who's standing over him at 3 o'clock in the morning, just staring down at him. So you can't be under much more stress than that outside of wartime. So I pulled him up first, talked to him. He told me the story. I looked at his energy level. He came up the steps pretty quickly, didn't have to use the handrails, came in, sat down, and he was nervous. He was edgy, but he had plenty of energy. I mean, his thoughts were coherent. His speech was coherent. He was nervous. He was afraid, but he wasn't lacking energy. So once I was done with him, he said, "You got to help me out. I'll do what I can for you, but I don't control this unit." I called up the schizophrenic, and that guy could barely make it up the steps. He was hanging onto the handrail. He came in, he slouched down in the chair. His speech was slow. He was very depressed. He didn't have any energy whatsoever. He told me about the voices and how they were attacking him, and that they were keeping him awake all night, that he wasn't on any medications. So I watched him leave, and he just drug himself back to the cell. And leaving the central detention unit that day, I went, it's not because of the anxiety. So it's like, okay, the voices have something to do with it, because you couldn't be under much more pressure, much more anxiety than that guy that the gangsters were trying to kill. And this was a perfect experimental situation. They were both in the same cell. They got the same food. They had the same guards. They had the same routine. I mean, everything was equaled out except for that. So I left there kind of mind boggled, like, okay, if it's not the negativity of the voices, if it's not the content of the voices, then what is it? And there was a one-to-one correspondence between the voices attacking and the energy leaving. And it dawned on me that the voices were taking their energy. They were siphoning that energy off. And I had several schizophrenic patients tell me they could feel the energy leaving when the voices were attacking. Okay. So, there was no doubt in my mind that these things were separate entities. And then it got worse as time went on. When I didn't quit, there was one patient where I started. I brought up the fact that Miguel Ruiz and started reading his book. He's a shaman that reported that these things were not only negative entities, but they were parasitic entities. They were actually stealing the person's energy, and they lived off that negative emotional energy. That explained why the voices were constantly negative. They never said anything good. It was always bad. It was always threats. It was always ugly. It was always anti-religious. It was always nasty stuff. They couldn't ignore these things because they got louder if they were ignored. So when I brought up what Miguel was saying about these voices being energetic parasites, this guy went into like a trance, and he was just staring at me like with this blank stare. And then behind my head erupted this electrical crackling. It was like an arc welder. It was just crack, 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 crack. And I turned around, I didn't see anything, and it started moving toward the right-hand wall of my office, and I saw nothing, I could smell nothing, it was just very loud. And I looked at this guy, and I said, "Do you hear that?" And he said nothing, he was just staring at me with this blank stare. And the crackling continued, it continued up the right-hand wall, and it was loud, bam, crack, 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 all the way to the top ceiling, and then it crossed over his head, crackling all the way, and then crack, 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 right toward me. And it jumped into this Rubbermaid trash can by my left leg. And I'm looking down there, but I didn't want to take my eyes off this guy because I thought he was going to attack. So I pushed my chair back against the wall, ready to kick him back if I had to. And I looked in that trash can, there was nothing there. And this went on for 20 seconds or 25 seconds, maybe a half minute. It wasn't anything brief. And after it ended, it jumped in the trash can, went silent. There was absolutely nothing in that trash can. I looked at him, and he gets up and he goes, "I gotta leave." And he slowly stood up and he shuffled out of the office down the hall. And I'm like, go, get out of here, go. And I was like, I was scared to death. So I went, after he left, I examined the walls. There were no burns. There was nothing I could see. There were no marks. I went out into the hall and walked down the hallway to see if there was anybody in any of the nurses or doctors' offices. There was nobody there. There was nothing that would account for that sound, for that cracking. And I was stunned. I couldn't see anybody the rest of the day. I just closed the office and stared out the window. You know, something was bad wrong. I'd opened something up and I didn't know how far it went. I didn't know the ground rules. I didn't have any map. I'm going, if they can do this, what else can they do? And I was scared. And I didn't call that guy back for probably 2 months. So after those 2 months, I finally got the nerve to call him back, put out a pass for him. The guards brought him to my office, you know, sat him down, and he looked fine. I thought he'd be destroyed based on what I saw the last time. He said, no, I've been doing what you said, and I'm able to hold them off. They haven't gained a whole lot of ground, but they haven't either. So it was like a standoff. And we did some small talk. And then I finally asked him, I said, did you hear that crackling noise the last time you were in my office? And he goes, yeah, I did, but I'm surprised that you did. And I said, well, what was that? And he said, that was them. And I said, the voices? And he said, yeah, that was the voices. And I said, well, what were they trying to do? And he said, they were trying to scare you off. I said, well, they did a damn good job of it. And this guy came across just, you know, like he did the last the time I saw him before that. I mean, he was making steady progress. And then I asked him, I said, what were they telling you as you were leaving the office, as you shuffled out of the office? He said, they were telling me to go get a shank and stick it in your gut. And I asked him, I said, well, why didn't you do that? And he said, I couldn't find one. So at that point, there was no doubt that these voices were a separate malicious entity. I learned in my early days at the Tate Hospital that if I was going to find out anything about them, I couldn't come across like they were hallucinations. Otherwise, the schizophrenics wouldn't tell me anything. They would just shut me off. Once I gave them the credit of the doubt, they started giving me little pieces. And I would piece that together, piece it together, piece it together, piece it together, until, you know, over the years, I had a list of traits, patterns that the voices ran. And I checked that out with scores of schizophrenics. Then I think Jenny heard one of my broadcasts one day bringing up this list. And she said, well, we need to concentrate on that. You know, she goes, I've experienced the same thing. I believe the same thing. We need to get that out as a separate interview because this is important. And if you look down these things, these patterns are patterns that we all experience to different degrees. So these things hit us all to different degrees, but they hit the schizophrenics the hardest. They pretty much have taken control of their lives. So, you know, Jenny has looked at these things and said, yeah, that's what I experienced.
And even Jerry, as a therapist, you know, when you listen to people and you listen to their irrational thoughts, they don't make sense. Sometimes not even from a historical viewpoint. There's nothing in their history really that would cause them to be thinking like that. And you suddenly realize these thoughts are not theirs. They are maybe, I mean, you could argue they're other incarnations. Maybe they're thoughts that have come from previous lifetimes. But from the viewpoint of this argument that we're discussing, quite clearly they are attached to the trauma in those people. They are attached to something in them. And they are really feeding off of the trauma and negative energy that these people are experiencing. Wouldn't you agree, Jerry?
Yeah, I'd say not only are they feeding on it, they are pouring gasoline on the fire. So one thing they do have is access to the person's memory. They can pull up every rotten thing that person has ever done, throw it in their face, and blame them for everything under the sun to create that negative emotional energy that they then drain and feed off. So, I mean, it's time after time after time this has happened. So I started experimenting with the prisoners I was working with, and I came up with a listing. It's like asking them how much energy they had before the voices attacked, how much during the attack, and how much after. And gave that to scores of different schizophrenics, and it ran the same pattern. After the attack, they were drained. They couldn't even get up to eat breakfast a lot of the times. So these things were actually feeding off of them. Some of them realized it, most of them didn't. And when you tried to point it out, they couldn't get it. You know, so with some of them, I'd ask them, okay, you've been hearing the voices for a decade, you know, over 10 years. Every time you hear the voices, your energy level goes down to nothing. Where do you think that energy goes? And I'd say 80% of them would say, I don't know. So I'm like, well, maybe they don't understand the correlation. So I'd say, well, if you stuck your hand in a fire, and every time you stuck your hand in a fire for 20 years, you got burned, what's burning you? They would have no trouble saying it was a fire. But they couldn't make the connection to the voices stealing their energy. Do you have anything to say about that, Jen, from your experience?
Oh, just hold that thought, Jenny. Jerry, do me a favor and turn off your webcam for a moment because it looks like you froze up. We've heard everything you said. Your image is just frozen. So turn off your webcam and then turn it back on. And then looks like you're coming back now. There you
there
are.
There we go.
Yeah, Jenny, okay, if you'd like to, you know, take up and also give us an idea of how the intrusive thoughts and voices first manifested in your life and how you had to cope with it and how was the psychiatric intervention in your case?
Yeah. Okay, thanks, James and Jerry. Well, for me, it started when I was just turned 23. I was in my final year at university. I was under a lot of pressure, obviously, and I was very sleepless. Very, very sleepless. And, you know, I'd already done a psychology qualification, so I understood that when there's extreme fatigue through sleeplessness that you can't organize your thoughts. At least this is one of the, you know, explanations that I understood it to be for a long, long time, that, you know, my thoughts were so scrambled because I had literally complete and utter sleeplessness for weeks and weeks, snatching minutes here and there if I could, chronic insomnia. So really, I suppose by the time I was really quite seriously affected, I was totally vulnerable. So these entities were very, very easy. I was a very easy prey for them. Also, just before I was probably about, so I was diagnosed in the May. I went into hospital in May the 7th, I think. And I started on that journey up to that wind-up point. So I was winding up all the way through January, February, March, April, May. And I sat in a spiritual circle with a group of people, and I was receiving information from, I don't know where, just voices coming into my head, random voices, about people in the room. You know, I'd say, deliver a message for somebody there. So I was kind of really just wide open psychically. I must have been like a shining beacon for these things to come and sort of take up residence, if you like, in my psyche. And I think, you know, probably in the Florida, sort of 6 weeks or so prior to going into hospital, there was a lot of erratic, irrational ideas about the world. You know, I really believed I was here to save the world, and I was running around like a mad thing and hardly eating. I was very thin, and there were lots of voices, lots of competing voices in my head for all sorts of things. Nothing at that moment that was negative or really bad, but very florid, you know, like very fantastical ideas that were beyond me. lots of writing. I was just writing and writing and writing, just spewing everything out on paper. So lots of confusing thoughts, i.e. voices. And when I was actually admitted on May the 7th, so I was very, very scrambled. My thinking was completely scrambled. I couldn't work out one voice from another. So I would be lying to say they had very clear messages for me, but the overall sense was to put terror in me. I was terrified by the thoughts I was having at the time, terrified by what might happen to me if I crossed the water. All of these ideas, really bizarre ideas, don't cross the water, if you go over the water you'll die. That translated into don't get in the bath, you know, because the only water I was really aware of was the bath, so I couldn't get in the bath. And it was just complete and utter scrambling of everything that you sort of trusted and thought was normal. You couldn't do anymore because it was all upside down, it was all back to front. And it really did feel like I was trapped in a parallel world where I could see what was going on around me, but all of my thoughts and thinking was being hijacked, was being sort of drawn into this parallel reality where there was no logic, no sense, nothing made sense in it. I've not described it like that before, but I'm just trying to go back and remember what it was like, because it was many years ago now, obviously. But my treatment from psychiatric, you know, I never perceived them as being, really unkind or deliberately nasty. I never perceived that. But they certainly didn't have a clue what they were dealing with. They had no idea what was going on for me, nor anyone there, because there were other people there, and I can remember one in particular, most definitely was being used by demonic entity attachments. Most definitely, now I go back and think about it, you know, he was most definitely one of their victims, and had the most bizarre thoughts and thinking. He was very attacked by them. He felt very vulnerable and attacked by them. Oh, but we all did. We all did. We weren't all schizophrenic in the ward. But there was this, Jerry and I talk about this, there was always this kind of like, you've got to take your medication. If you don't take it, we'll inject you. If you don't take your medication and we inject you, then we'll have to section you, which means that you have your liberty taken away from you. And of course, all you need is two doctor's signatures on that. So now it's only one after coronavirus, but at that time you had to have two. So it was very easy for them to, you know, put it out to a colleague on the ward, some other doctor somewhere. So they always used that as a threat. If you don't take your medication, we will section you. And it was almost like I didn't know what the hell that was. It wasn't until they explained it to me what that meant. And then you realise if they section you, you are literally, you have no liberty. You cannot do anything or go anywhere. You are in lockup. So it was always like a big threat, you know, that they used with people. And also the threat of having injections. If you didn't take the medication, we'll inject you. Now, you know, subsequently, obviously, all these years later, when I've interviewed a lot of people myself that were involved in psychiatric discovery, if you like, a guy called Daniel Mackler. He looked at alternative treatments for schizophrenia, and I interviewed him one year. And these people, you know, like, it's like the way we are treated, the way patients are treated with schizophrenia in these institutions is inhumane, because there is no understanding, there is no concept. It's not their fault, they just don't know. They've not been trained or, you know, in any way shown or given the freedom to even explore.
Now, that's
what
true.
That's going
true.
On.
When I tried asking patients, what are the voices telling you? I got in trouble with psychiatry. So, Jen, you want to tell them what those drugs were like and whether they helped you at all? What was it like to take those things?
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous. I would say I can't remember clearly. I've got it all in my medical records because I did actually retrieve them because I wanted to have my memory jog. There were lots of things I'd forgotten, but they were all there in my notes. But I think the first one I went on to was Lagaptil. And that, if that's the one I'm thinking of, that absolutely paralysed my body. So my body was stiff, but my brain was highly active. So, you know, from a clinician's point of view, I look like I'm calm, but I'm anything but calm. What's happened is that my body is paralysed, so I can't move. So that's what that did. And then they changed it onto something called Seladine and Procyclodine. So the Seladine was a blue pill and the Procyclodine was a little white pill. And the Seladine, I used to call them my uppers and downers because they were meant to harness some of the wild thinking. And they didn't. They didn't at all. I was, you know, running around like a mad thing, losing weight, on the run constantly. It was like I had entities over my shoulder running after me. On the one hand, it was you know, you could kind of enter into a different world, and it was on some level intriguing, so intriguing, but on the other level it was absolutely terrifying. And the drugs did nothing at all. Eventually, they put me on something called haloperidol. I don't know if you've got that in the States, in Australia. Haldol. Do you know it? Haldol, yeah, that's right. And the haloperidol, I remember coming down. So when I went onto that, my whole energy level just sunk, crashed. On Stelazine, I was up there with the, you know, up there with hyperactivity. With haloperidol, I absolutely crashed. And my body went stiff again. And I started to trudge around, you know, you call it the shuffle. There's this kind of endless stepping from side to side. And that is awful. So I was on these drugs. I was in hospital for about 3 months. And then I was sent home. I was in Liverpool, which is about 250 miles from my hometown near London. And I'd come back to Essex and I spent another few weeks in an Essex hospital, and then I was sent home with drugs. And the drugs made me clumsy, I couldn't move, I certainly wasn't feeling any better mentally. The confusion had gone, all of the competing voices had gone, but my body was like so stiff, I could not tell you. And after about 2 or 3 months of coming home to my parents' house, I just thought, I'm not having this. I can't have this. My medical records said, in no uncertain terms, that I must never come off my medication. I didn't know that at the time, obviously. But I did. I just stopped my medication. Now, for anyone watching this, be careful. It is, you know, the best way to do it is wean yourself off. But I just stopped. And fortunately, everything was fine. I got my mobility back, the voices disappeared, and then I started sleeping. And I slept. I think my mind and body had been on such high energy for such a long time. I must have slept around the clock for about 6 months.
Now, these are some of the most dangerous drugs that are used in medicine today. Did the psychiatrist ever sit you down and tell you how dangerous these things were? And what side effects to watch out for as your nervous system is being rotted out by these things?
No, of course not. And I think I've said before, Jerry, that even if they had would have done that, you know, in my case, my head was so busy. There's no way I would have understood what they were saying and really been able to make an informed choice, you know.
What gets me is when you did clear up, you know, and they told you have to be on those for the rest of your life. They didn't mention what these things do to your nervous system long-term.
I mean, no.
They are very dangerous drugs. And what gets me is I've never seen a psychiatrist curious about what the voices are telling people. They just blow them off like, oh, they're hallucinations, because that's what they've been programmed to believe. So they're not thinking outside of the box they've been programmed into in medical school. And, you know, they're spiritually devoid. And as long as they keep on that path, they are never going to find out the cause of schizophrenia. You know, they're going to keep drugging people and inducing these chemical lobotomies. So who knows? Probably the rest of my lifetime, for sure. They cure nobody. I mean, those drugs cure nothing.
Did you get the impression, Jenny, not only in your personal experience, but in discussions you've had with others who had similar challenges to overcome, did it ever seem at some point that these voices would try to alter your moral compass, try to not only instill indecision and uncertainty and lack of belief in yourself, but also, you know, make some inroads in a potentially changing your behaviors in a negative way?
Well, interestingly, because my brain was so scrambled and I didn't really know who was saying what, where the voices were coming from, what was mine, what was anyone else's, it was just very confusing. There was one incident where I was left in a room with a priest or a vicar or a local holy man, and he laid his hand on my stomach and he put another one on my back, and I thought I could hear him uttering profanities, like something like F you, F you, F you, F you, or something like that. Jerry, when we spoke about this last time, Jerry was convinced that that was probably them speaking to me through him, that he wasn't saying that. But I do also know that, you know, you're not really safe in an institution from anyone. You are prey for anyone. And in light of, you know, modern day events, we know what we're talking about. You know, vulnerable people, children are prey to anyone. And, you know, so I don't think I ever really sensed that people were trying to hijack my moral compass as such. It wasn't that they were trying to get me to do stuff I wasn't prepared to do. It was the trauma and the fear that they were enjoying feeding off of. I think probably when we're looking at inmates in a prison, probably, you know, it's not so far away from what maybe their background was for them to then be led into more immoral or, you know, licentious work as such. But in my case, obviously, I was just an innocent young 23-year-old just trying to get my degree. There was nothing there that led me into thinking that I should be doing something evil or unpleasant.
Well, I can tell you that is so with the prisoners, though. I mean, the schizophrenics, for the most part, if they don't have support, they have no way to support themselves other than to steal or you know, break the law. So once they close down the all the state hospitals, they send them to prison, and they come out of there worse than what they went in. They're angrier, they're colder, they're harsher, they're more calculating, and then they release them on society with 2 weeks worth of pills and say, when you run out of pills, go to the nearest ER. And the ER is not going to give them anything other than just temporarily. They're not going to set them up with drugs or anything like that. So, I mean, what they're doing is a crime.
Excuse me. And as far as the nature of these voices, Jenny, when you were able to slow things down enough to, like, differentiate, so I've heard accounts of sometimes these thoughts come in rapid profusion, sometimes they're more measured. When things had kind of slowed down sufficiently, whether it was post the treatments or not, how did these voices manifest to you? Did you hear them singly, or did it seem like there was a chorus of them, or how did that play out?
I think there were a lot of them. I think there were a lot of voices. There were lots of, it was a cacophony of sound. I remember sat opposite a psychiatrist who was asking me questions, stupid questions like, do you want to kill yourself? Or, you know, can you hear voices? And very simple, stupid questions, you know. And I just remember saying to him, stop asking me stupid questions. Because, you know, I couldn't even think straight. There was so much going on. It was like my whole consciousness was hijacked. If I go back and slow some stuff down, I remember, for example, looking into the eyes of friends that had come to visit me, and it was like seeing something, some different entity. It's like I wasn't looking at my friends, I was seeing another entity. It was like there was an unconscious communication between myself and other entities, in the minds attached to my friends, you know, people that came to see me. It was almost like, I mean, when I first went into practice as a therapist 20 years ago, I had a massive sort of a realization, epiphany type thing, and suddenly I had what I call x-ray vision. I could just see through. I could see through people. And, you know, people would come and sit opposite me, and it would take a moment for me to know what was going on for them. And, you know, going back to that time when I was in my early 20s in psychiatric, it was like I could suddenly see different entities attached to different people. That's how I would explain it now. I'm going back and overlaying what I know now onto what I remember about then. And, you know, I remember looking into the eyes of my friends, the eyes of my friends in particular. I would really study them. And they would be obviously quite alarmed because they're looking at me and they can't see what I'm doing, but I can see what's attached to them. It was just bizarre, really. It was like I could see through them and to whatever it is that was attached to them that wanted to speak to me. So it's very hard to slow them down. I mean, I'd even go as far as to say, it was such a feasting ground. My head was so busy. I was so traumatized. I was so disorganized and chaotic that it was difficult to discern one voice from another. It was, you know, that there were times when, for example, I wouldn't get in the bath. I couldn't get in the bath. It was impossible. And the nurse would stand next to me and say, why can't you do it? And I'd say to her, because I can't cross the water. I can't cross the water. You know, I mean, where did that idea come from? The stick, you know, I don't know, can't remember who it is now, but, you know, where does that idea come? Why can't I cross the water? Who's telling me that I can't cross the water? Where does that come from? So it's hard to answer that question, James, because I didn't stay schizophrenic long enough for me to really get to know these entities and to get to know what was going on for me. What's your sense, James? Because I know we spoke briefly before the call. There was a sense in you about attachments and voices and things that you'd heard yourself. What are you taking from what we're talking about
here? Well, it's ironic that the people who came to visit you, to check up on you and provide support, that through whatever means, through whatever process, you were able to see and clairaudiently hear that they were similarly, to more or less degree, afflicted. So you see, that's kind of ironic. And it's in line with the findings of myself and my colleagues in our investigations in alien abductions into spirit possession, demonic possession, what have you. I'm not saying they're all the same, but I think that they're somewhat cut from the same cloth. There seems to be this nether dimensional parasitic environment in which we seem to be a part of. And unfortunately, most people don't seem to be aware of the nature of the environment, the multiple threat environment in which we reside. When you were looking at these people, did you see, like with your etheric third eye vision perhaps, did you see an entity or entities overshadowing their host physical bodies? And if so, what did they appear to you as?
there was another guy called Tony, and I subsequently discovered he died while he was in the hospital with me. I didn't know, I never knew before then, but I remember talking to him, and there was a fatalism about him. There was a sense that it was his time to go. If I think back, he was always laughing. He wasn't schizophrenic, he had bipolar or something else. He was always laughing, but there was always a sense around him that he was being dragged away. There was always a sense he was being dragged away by something, that he wouldn't be with us long. I was surprised when he disappeared, and I started asking, where's Tony? And they wouldn't tell me initially. It was only weeks later that they said, oh, well, he died. And he had died in hospital. I think he'd had a heart attack or a stroke or something quite, you know, severe. But so it was difficult to say. I could see with my eyes. I couldn't see. I could only perceive. And that's been me all my life. It's almost like, you know, my natural perception, my natural ability, my natural talent, if you like, is to perceive, but not to see. I can sense very clearly, but I can't see. So the one friend I'm thinking about, who, when I looked into her eyes, it was like they were trying to communicate with me. It was like they were trying to hook into me. Whatever it was, there was an energy coming from her that was trying to hook into mine. Almost like perhaps they were looking for an extra bit, somebody else to hang on to. This particular friend as well was quite an unusual friend. She did actually have quite a clingy sort of sense about her. She would hold on to you and cling to you physically. So I think really, you know, that this one particular person I'm thinking of, that comes through in the eyes very clearly, and you realise that, or at least I realised that entity was communicating with me. It wasn't her, it was something else. It was fear. It was almost like a fear of being alone or left out. And that was what that's what that entity from her was wanting in me. It didn't want to be on its own. It wanted to be with someone. That's all I can describe, really. I don't know if that answers any questions there.
Well, it does. And since then, I don't know, you know, how much of that ability you've retained. You mentioned you just always had this gift of perception. To some degree or another, have you noticed this overshadowing entity, malign entity influence, not only in people in general, but in people of authority, like doctors, medical health professionals, politicians, news presenters? Have you seen that also play out in those particular demographics?
Yeah, absolutely, loads. Jerry and I, when we talked about this in the summer just gone, and we talked about the ways in which the media and all of these authoritative people are running this show in the last 18 months, 20 months. Every time I listen to anything, whether it's mainstream or alt media, I can sense when there's an attachment, when there's, this is just totally disingenuous. This is not real. One of my tricks is to watch or listen to a video and turn the sound off. And just perceive with your senses, because the sound is distracting. But if I watch and I perceive, I can sense immediately whether these people are genuine or not. I can look at it. I've not studied how to tell a lie. I've not done any of that study. I just know intuitively. So the whole of the media is riddled with these demonic entities, that's all I can call them, attachments. Everywhere is riddled with these attachments. Every single person they call them NPCs, non-player characters, when you speak to somebody and they come out with the same thing again and again, and there's no discussion and no opening of the mind, and you can't get any further with it. You just know they're possessed. They are being possessed. They have been what we would term, you know, in modern culture, brainwashed. But it's bigger than that. They've been traumatized, so that these entities have a foothold to hold on to them.
Yeah. Should we go through the listing of things that schizophrenic voices tell?
Yeah, please. Yeah, and the time we got left in this first segment, please, Jerry.
Yeah, and as we're doing that, you know, look, everybody experiences these things to some degree. You know, so it's not just schizophrenics we're talking about. These things get us all. You know, so everybody hears a voice in their head, constantly talking to them, constantly running them down, constantly telling them what to do. And we're taught from the time we're born that those thoughts are you. But if they're you, then who's listening to those thoughts? You are not your thoughts. Swedenborg brought that up 300 years ago. Your thoughts are different from who you are. You're the listener. You're the one who's watching the images. You know, you're the one that's hearing those thoughts. And what surprised me, the one time I heard them, because I prayed to hear them, they sounded just like the thousands of other thoughts I have in my head all day long, except the intent was far different than anything I would intend for myself, which is one of the ways to tell them apart. So one of their main aspects is they're negative. They're virtually always negative. And if they're not, they're angling for something or, acting positive, saying, I'm Jesus Christ, or I'm some spirit that's going to help you. But the consistent trait is they're consistently negative. You know, they're derogatory, insulting, abusive, destructive. They may seem to be helpers for a while, but invariably they turn on the victim once they gain their trust and begin attacking them and eroding their self-confidence. Do you have anything to say about that one, Jenny?
Yeah, when it comes to the media and you look at the kind of disgusting coverage on mainstream media about so-called anti-vaxxers or, you know, people that are struggling for our freedoms, the disgusting, negative, derogatory, insulting, abusive and destructive language that's being used against one segment of society is absolutely unforgivable. And it's negative. It's negative from beginning to end.
Right. The second trait is anti-religious. Yeah, they're consistently anti-religious. They resist the victim attending church, reading the Bible, or following any other positive spiritual path. They become volatile if the patient reads the 23rd Psalm, the Lord's Prayer, or positive spiritual verses, which is odd. Why would a hallucination get angry at somebody reading the 23rd Psalm or reading the Bible? One patient reported that his voices reacted to the repetition of the 23rd Psalm like worms being thrown on a hot frying pan. I've heard that from more than one patient saying the same thing. So why would a hallucination be anti-religious? Why would a hallucination be consistently, unswervingly negative? Do you have any comments on the anti-religious thing, Jen?
Yeah, just that, don't go to church. Don't practice your religion with other people. Only the state can save you. Only the special medicine can save you. Nothing else can save you. Don't go to God. Don't go to your religious gatherings. We are your saviors. So you've got something going on there.
Yeah. Look at what it was in Canada. The police raided a church and tried to break up the congregation. You know, they show no respect for anything. Psychiatry and the mainstream media are just anti-religious, anti-spiritual, no spiritual background whatsoever. Number three, they foster and create negative emotion. So they will actually inject negative thoughts into your mind, into your thought stream, that will create the negative emotional energy that they feed off of. They can't create that themselves. You know, so they have to have us create it, like we milk cows. And then the farmer puts the cow out into the pasture, it eats the grass, it converts it to milk. The farmer takes it, isolates it, and then milks it. And that's exactly what these things are doing to us, especially schizophrenics, which are the main milk cows. They already mentioned they energetically drain their victims. What's odd is they get louder after sunset. And I've heard this from scores of different patients. You know, after sunset, they get louder. There's something called sun damage syndrome that happens with the geriatric population, where they start getting more out of control after the sun goes down.
And the interesting thing, we drew a parallel there, Jerry, in one of our interviews, was that, you know, that's when the mainstream media is capturing people's attention, which is, you know, everyone's got home from work, and there comes the mainstream media with its messages of doom and gloom.
Yeah,
which is very energetically draining. People get really scared by what they're listening to on the media. All of these cases, and there's no cure, which is a complete and utter, you know, fabrication. And there's only one thing for it: the state has your back. Never mind anybody else. You know, the health service has your back. You can't get out of this without that special medicine.
And the voices get the loudest between 3 and 4 in the morning for some reason. You know, they wake the patient up, start screaming at them, and it just goes on. So they do everything they can to prevent the person from getting sleep, which weakens them and leaves them more susceptible to their suggestions. They're constantly fostering self-destructive behavior. That's one thing I learned at the state hospital when I was working at the psychiatric rehabilitation center there. We would train high-level patients in auto mechanics and hair styling and that kind of stuff. When they would get close to graduating, they would do something to screw themselves up. And consistently, they would sabotage themselves. So these things are constantly fostering self-destructive behavior. They increase conflict, turmoil, and suffering. They sabotage any positive movement on the part of the patient. And the intent of the voices is very different from the intent of the person themselves. Another big one is they foster isolation. They want to break up families. They want to break up marriages. They want to break up relationships.
And that, Jerry, is such a major part of this whole plan, is to isolate everybody, not only in our homes, but even from our families, because we're living under threat that the WHO can reach into our very half of our family and take our children off of us if we do not comply with their special medicine and with their special orders. So this isolation, and sorry, I'm clicking on my thing here, to isolate people, make them paranoid, I'm reading all the things here, destroy marriages and positive relationships. Just look at what's happening. You know, James, you can probably see it where you are more than anywhere else in the world, this divisiveness, this division between the haves and the have-nots, if you know what I mean, and the way in which they're being pitted against each other. You know, you can only capture somebody's mind if you keep them isolated. This is a torture technique, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it matches the mainstream media, the psychotic voices. Their ultimate aim is to get the victim to shut out all others. So it's just the voices and the person. And that's what the mainstream media are doing. They're trying to break up everybody. They're trying to isolate everybody. Stay 6 feet apart. Don't talk. Wear your mask. Stay away from everybody. You're going to die if you don't do this. They isolate the victim and insert negative, paranoid, destructive thoughts into the individual's thought stream. And much of this is lies, because the lies have as much of an effect as the reality. So it's easier just to lie to people. There's a one-to-one correspondence between what the psychotic voices are telling schizophrenics and what the mainstream media is doing right now. They demand the attention of their victims. you know, look at the television. You turn it on, it's like, oh, this is happening now, and this guy was killed, and this violence happened. And they're constantly demanding your attention. They can't get through to you unless they can grab and hook your attention. And that's exactly what the voices do. Go ahead.
Sorry. And you say here on your list here, in a myriad of ways, and what struck me about, you know, recent months even, is the number of different celebrities and spokespeople that have come out in favor of the special medicine. And, you know, these people are from a massive, diverse, to attack, if you like, every segment of society. Everyone is receiving a message from someone, and it's going to hit most people. Unless you're immune to it and you can see what's going on, people are going to say, oh, my favorite pop star is taking it. Oh, that person who does nothing but good is taking it. It must be good. There's this kind of constant attacking of your consciousness, as though you have no control of your own mind, and all you have to do is listen to these spokespeople and they'll put you straight. Don't trust your inner voice. Don't trust who you are. Trust us. We have all the answers.
Yeah.
There's definitely a hive consciousness at work that is, it capitalizes on, in my view, the genetic de-evolution of the human race at large, the diminishing of the neurological capacity, the inability to process information, the inability to intuitively connect with valid sources of information and with a higher source of truth. There has been some blockages installed, and then the repeated messages from these entity infested news presenters and health ministers, et cetera, it reinforces all these OCD thought loops that many of these people thus afflicted from these voices are already having to deal with. It reinforces, you know, the messaging, it reinforces the programming. Well, we reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guests, Jenny and Jerry. And Jenny, would it be okay if people reached out to you and contact you via email? And if so, can you provide a means to contact you?
Yeah, of course. You can. My website's a bit old, but it's openmindtherapy.co.uk. And you can reach me on Jenny at openmindtherapy.co.uk. I've also got a professional website for my colleagues, and that's theopenmindtherapist.com, Jenny at theopenmindtherapist.com.
And Jerry, can you give the listeners and viewers your contact information?
Yeah, they can contact me at jerrymarzynski.com. We have a host of scores of videos there. We have interviews. We have that's a live program and different programs they can use to weaken the voices. There's a host of all kinds of information at jerrymarzynski.com.
And for our viewers out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see the members at the top of the next segment.